end is not just about saving the planet, it's about the people on the planet, and the people on the planet bearing the brunt of it are black.
You're listening to Climate Curious, a podcast for people who care about the world but find the current conversation about climate change confusing, boring, or scary. Okay, so we're back again. Hello, Mariam. How are you feeling this week? I know you're feeling a little bit anxious last week.
Let me tell you, what a difference a week makes. Well, what a difference a week makes. What a difference four days made. I am feeling good. I'm feeling good. And you know what? Like, I'm not going to get into the details here, but I'm feeling hopeful. I've been thinking a lot this week about how we can celebrate wins and celebrate good things, even if we know that there's more work that needs to be done. I feel like after 5 years of essentially being in total darkness, I see a little light at the end of the tunnel. And I know that it's really far away and I have a long way to go to get there, but there's a light for the first time.
And it's doubly sweet, right, because of representation. I don't know if that's too specific, but...
Yeah, it is.
It just feels nicer, a little bit nicer.
To have a woman of color elected to such a high office, I think it, you know, anywhere in the world, I think it's just such a win. Yeah, I'm feeling good.
That's good. Your optimeter is high today.
Yeah, like, so we always talk about how you're optimistic you're feeling, but yeah, my optimistic dial has turned up a few notches.
That's good. I'm happy about that. I feel like the world... I feel like that's a resounding feeling. Do you know what I mean? Like, generally across the board, like, spirits are feeling a little bit higher.
Like, if we go all the way back to what Charmian was saying in our very first episode, you know, both and. Like, I can both feel happy and hopeful and know that I still have work to do. So that's what I'm embracing. I'm embracing the both and of it.
Right. Okay. So today's episode, we're talking... about some really interesting stuff, actually. And this is probably a conversation that I feel like, I want to have. Do you know what I mean? Like, out of all of the conversations that we've had, this is definitely number one on my agenda. And I'm going to start us off with a question, bearing in mind that neither of us are white people. And I want to know, when as a non-white person, did you start to realize or start to care about climate change and realize that it was an issue for you?
That is such a difficult question to answer. So I can tell you that I've always kind of cared about climate change, but in a very abstract way. And so when I was really little, I wanted to save jaguars in the rainforest. You know, even in my, over the last, like, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, I've had real sympathy towards the climate change movement. And I've tried to make good climate decisions, but not really, as our confessions have shown. But I think that this year I was like, just dove headfirst into this conversation, into this discussion, into this world through my work. And I have to be very honest that I had never thought about the intersection of climate change and race, except for, you know, and I think you might agree with this, except for this idea that in faraway places, you know, there are things happening to, you know, black and brown people, that are to do with like water scarcity or to, you know, so I, in that sense that in like faraway places, we can see the first impacts of climate change and it's happening to black and brown people. That I've known for a long time, right? Because that's more of, I guess, my background and my work. But I hadn't really connected it to me in the UK or like in the West until this summer. This is really new for me. I had the privilege of working with some amazing people who are doing just that, but in the US. And it really struck me. And once you see it, this is something you can't unsee.
Right. Because for me, it's today, right? Like, I've thought about it. And I know enough to say that climate change disproportionately affects people of color. But beyond that, I wouldn't say I know very much about the topic at all. And I feel like I should. Do you know what I mean? I feel like I'm meant to know the answers. But I think that's why we're lucky to have the guest that we have today, right?
Yes, exactly. Our guest this week is, in my mind, the perfect person to take us through this exploration of race and climate change, essentially. So I'm really excited because this week we're joined by the Right Honourable David Lammy, who is the Member of Parliament for Tottenham and who also spoke at the TED Countdown conference in October. So you, if you haven't already, definitely check out his TED talk. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with David's amazing work, I really want to tell you a little bit about him because I think I'll give you context to where this conversation is going and where he's coming from. David has been a long-term advocate for fighting for justice on behalf of the Windrush generation. He's campaigned for a humane immigration system. He's sought compensation for the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire. He has worked to expose racial bias in the British criminal justice system. In fact, he was appointed Shadow Secretary of State for Justice in April this year, and he's the first Black MP to hold the justice post, either in government or opposition. So I think there could not be a more perfect person to help us have this conversation, Ben. Mm. Let's get started, shall we?
Let's go.
Welcome, David. It's so lovely to have you on the podcast with us.
Thank you so much for asking me.
I want to start right at the beginning and ask you, how did the climate emergency become a priority for you?
Well, look, I think that this is a combination of two things creeping up over time. The one is representing an inner city seat in London. Tottenham is at the sort of epicenter, really, of Britain's Black community, its Asian minority ethnic community. It is a seat with much deprivation, and it's absolutely at the forefront of London's housing crisis. And so I'm meeting lots of families who have really poor housing. They're overcrowded. They are living in polluted areas. Their kids have asthma. There's sickness, there's stress, and actually many of them may be working in pollutant industries, in factories and things on the outskirts of London. So that's one group of people. It doesn't matter whether it's London, LA, New York, it's replicated. Black people doing really challenging jobs with really challenging housing, living in areas that are often left behind. And then it is my knowledge of the developing world. I mean, my cousins, my family are in Guyana, where my parents were from. It's the second poorest country in the Western Hemisphere after Haiti. It has much beauty in terms of its rainforests, the Amazon basin, the wonderful fauna species, but it is a country with rising sea levels. It's below sea level, huge problems with floods. In fact, as we are recording this podcast, Tropical Storm Eta is ripping its way through the Caribbean with huge floods, mudslides in Jamaica, Honduras, countries like that, and Guyana's in that zone. So it's basically, for me, I got to climate change because I saw the way that people I came into politics to help, you know, Black and brown people to some extent, whether they are in urban centres like London or whether they are in developing countries like Guyana, are suffering. And the thing that connects the dots is the climate emergency.
So I find this really interesting, and I feel like my starting point for this conversation is always like, how is this relevant to me, right? But I'm always trying to center myself so that I can understand things. And I was having a conversation actually the other week with a pastor in one of the churches that I grew up going to, so a Black guy. We met for a coffee, we were sitting down and we were chatting, and he was looking through my social media. He was like, I follow loads of the stuff that you do and I listen to all the conversations you've been having, but you never have conversations that black people have. And I found that really jarring, like, in a, because I, in one sense, I was like, nah, you're chatting rubbish. That's not relevant. But in another sense, I kind of get the point that was being made, right? Which is that to a certain extent, and this is what I'm interested to know from you, because I don't actually know the answer, whether it's that black people are having this conversation and we just don't see that happening, or whether black people are not having this conversation and it's something that needs to be pushed harder. But I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Look, I don't think it's as straightforward as that. So the truth is, my experience of people who are poor, people who have trouble paying the bills, mm-hmm. people who are being harassed by the police, people who are worried about where food's coming from because they've just lost their job. And, you know, I'm thinking of a lot of black people in that position, is they haven't got time to worry about what appears to be big picture policy, because there are a lot of daily stresses. And that's certainly the context in which I grew up. And so that's one conversation. And the other conversation is, if the climate emergency is all about carbon emissions, if it's about the Green New Deal, but you never connect that to equity, to jobs that matter to people in their communities, that seem real, then of course black people aren't going to be thinking about this, which is why I did my TED Talk, one, to connect the dots, to challenge both those who are in environmental organisations, those who are raising their voice about these issues, to remind them that this in the end is not just about saving the planet, it's about the people on the planet, and the people on the planet bearing the brunt of it are black, but also to challenge the black community that if we are protesting for George Floyd, and if we are using the motif, I can't breathe, then please remember that there are thousands of people who can't breathe because they are literally being choked in their communities, or they are experiencing drought, flood, pollution in the global south. And so it's to connect the dots. It's not to exceptionalize one group. I've campaigned as a result of George Floyd's murder, but I'm not going to exceptionalize the African-American experience and not say that black people that die in Darfur, which is the first climate change war, if you like, or civil war, if you like, are somehow less important. They are as important. Mm. And until we live in a world where that is fully understood, none of us are truly free.
Right. Because that to me makes sense. Like, I understand. I always think about my parents in regards to these kinds of conversations. Like, I think there is an element of the black experience, I guess, that means that loads of things that are really important become luxury conversations. Do you know what I mean? Whether it's like mental health or sexual health or physical health. I'm interested in what the impact of climate change, because I always think of climate change in terms of the global south, right? Like, I always think, oh, there's islands that are going to be underwater in 10 years or 20 years or whatever it might be. And I find it a lot harder. I know you spoke about this in your TED talk, but I find it a lot harder to place like the immediate consequences for people here, particularly for people of color. Like, I know that there are things, but I find it really hard to like pinpoint them and say,
UK?
Yeah.
Well, look, who is in the most pollutant jobs?
Is that a rhetorical question? No, okay, it is. Go on.
You know, whose kids have got asthma? We had a wonderful young woman, Ellie Kissadebra, who died, barely into her teens, died because of pollution in this city, in part because of the emissions. You could go to the United States, you could look at zoning policy and why homes for traditional African Americans were in the poorest areas, the most pollutant areas of American cities. You just have to go to Kingston, Jamaica to see the pollution in that city. Yeah. And, you know, who drives the most pollutant cars? Who are the people who are working in agriculture and exposing themselves to insecticides, things like that, that they shouldn't be, or who are doing, you know, really tough jobs and being exposed to pollutants of all kinds? Who are the cleaners in London? Mm. What's the face of those cleaners? If you get on the tube at 6:30 in the morning, who is coming home from work? Mm. Look at the people who died during the beginning of this crisis. The face of those care workers, the face of those bus drivers that were dropping dead because of the viral load. What is the face of inequality in our country? So, and inequality is inextricably linked to the coronavirus. If we want to talk about a decolonized curriculum or a Britain in which we no longer have statues celebrating people like Edward Colston, what was that colonization about? It was about extraction. It was about forced labor. A forced labor that gave the world cotton, gave the world sugar, mining in countries like South Africa, the Congo. Countries fought over because of what was in the ground. And the debate that we're having today about the oil industry, fossil fuels, the extractive economy is inextricably linked to the labour of black and brown people. So it's kind of know your history and know what climate is really about, because it's the dismantling of that that we're up for. And when we talk about a New Deal and a Green New Deal, who is it that's going to get those new jobs? You know, who needs those new jobs? What does equity look like if we're serious about who should benefit? Mm-hmm. So on many, many layers, I think that this is a story that we have to connect to race and racial identity and to the Black Lives Matter cause. If Black Lives Matter, then you've got to deal with the climate emergency.
Mm. And when you say learn your history or know your history, how does someone find out that stuff? Like, so me personally, rather than abstract person out in the world, me, Ben Hurst, I am moderately dyslexic. I don't like reading books. I don't particularly enjoy history. When I was in school, it was one of my least favourite subjects. And I feel like the history that you've given, right, because you've given all the picture that you've painted, because it wasn't all history, but the picture that you've painted, current and past, is quite a vivid picture of drastic inequality, which is obviously true, right? But for average layperson listening to the podcast who thinks, I don't know where to find this stuff, how do you find those pieces of information and manage to put them together in a way that makes sense?
In my speech, I mentioned a couple of organisations. Wretched of the Earth is one that you can Google who are on these issues. Mm-hmm. But I would say that, you know, you're right, Ben, a lot of people aren't connecting the dots. Obviously, if you are dyslexic, you're not into reading, then you can, you know, people like David Olusoga in this country, Afua Hirsch, are writing a lot about race, colonialism. You know, get into what they're saying. But I suppose with what I'm saying, in your mind, connect the story they're telling of colonialism to the exploitation of people today, is the point. And that usually comes back to climate. Let me give you another, what might sound like a random subject, but is connected to this, to illustrate this point. Mm-hmm. So for hundreds of years, unfortunately, black people have come into contact with the criminal justice system. One of the things that brings them into contact with the criminal justice system, whether it's in Canada, whether it's in America, whether it's in New Zealand or in London, is the stop and search policies of the police. And one of the things that you know people get stopped and searched for is cannabis. And that can lead to a criminal record, and in many countries it can lead to imprisonment. Now, there's a movement across the world which is to decriminalise and legalise cannabis. Canada has begun that movement. Lots of US states have begun that movement. But the question is, as they decriminalise and new companies that legitimate growing cannabis set up, where is the equity for black and brown people who were traditionally arrested and thrown in jail? Right. Do they get the contracts to run a farm, or to or to have a warehouse? Yeah. So it's similar to when we talk about the New Deal and jobs. Who are getting the jobs? Because who lost out before? So I suppose what I'm saying is, you may not be able to Google all of this stuff. You can Google bits of it, but we need to get better at joining the dots. And the climate movement needs to get better at joining the dots. And black communities need to get better at joining the dots. That is why it is an emergency. Or we deal with climate and leave black and brown people out of the story. And I don't think that's actually possible, the more I think about it.
Do you think that one of the reasons here, one of the things here that is striking when you have this conversation is that there are so many leading NGOs, people who are running, who are really leading this conversation, who are not black and brown, that the diversity and who we see reflects the idea that it's not for us, that the conversation isn't for us because we don't see people that look like us leading it?
Well, look, let me just be clear. I don't want to give, anyone who is white listening to this kind of the shakes or to sort of feel somehow that they can't be in this business. And I thank them for all that they're doing,
Don't worry about it. But
I suppose there has been a challenge that the leadership of many of these organizations is not vaguely diverse. The thing you could do, for example, is, you could locate, I'm not going to name some of the major NGOs in this area. You know who they are, and they, in many ways, they do a wonderful job. But why could you not locate or headquarter yourself in a community like Tottenham? Wouldn't it? I mean, Tottenham has not got a major, or Brixton, or Willesden, or Moss Side, or Handsworth. We have no major NGO located in our employing people. Wouldn't that be great? And perhaps because you'd see the pollution, you'd see the challenges, you might employ a few black and brown people as well. So that's one thing you could do. The next thing we need to do is we need environmental scientists that come from communities like the one I represent. We need bursaries at universities so that they can get into this stuff. They can be articulate in this stuff, versed in this stuff. Where are those bursaries? Where are those opportunities? How are they sponsored? How do you study environmental science if you haven't got the funds to persuade you to pick that over something else? So there are ways in which this can change, I think, in the sector. And I think it's also true to say, there are fantastic development NGOs like, say, Christian Aid, by the way, who have been raising issues, connecting the dots, particularly with the Global South. So we've got to sort of think about the language and join things up, and so we can make progress.
You said earlier something I want to pick up on, because I, by the way, think there's such an appetite for this conversation. Your TED talk, your TED Countdown talk came out just under a month ago, and it has 800,000 views and has been translated.
I didn't actually know that because I haven't looked at it for 800,000. That's quite a lot.
800,000 is a huge number. It's in less than a month and 11 languages. So this conversation around the intersection of race and climate change, I think is only going to gain traction, right? And I want to ask you about something you kind of mentioned earlier and get you to expand on it, which is you said, I don't think it's possible to do one without the other now. And that's something I think that a lot of leaders that I've spoken to are also coming to, but it's scary for them because for a long time, climate justice and social justice have not been talked about together. You know, why do you think they are so essentially linked? And how can one help us unlock the other?
Well, look, I think, let's just start with this year and the themes of this year. Let's start with life before coronavirus. And one of the big stories before the coronavirus was organizations like Extinction Rebellion, young people protesting and calling for change by 2030. It was the climate movement. And then we, the work of Greta Thunberg and others, then we get coronavirus, and right through coronavirus is deep inequality. And that inequality, is the face of that is in a couple of ways. Who's dying in care homes? Who are those women that work in care homes often? They're black, ethnic minorities. Why are black people and brown people dying disproportionately in cities like London and New York? And then there's another meta story, which is when we get a vaccine, and we had a vaccine, sort of progress on a vaccine announced yesterday, how will we ensure that the global south has access to that vaccine and isn't just left out of the story? Particularly in a context in which we have President Trump in the United States looking totally inward and denying the disease. And the UK has not been in a leadership position because we're so preoccupied with leaving the European Union. And then we also have Black Lives Matter. And we had this huge moment as a result of the murder of George Floyd. And I think particularly millennials, white and black, saying enough is enough. We need action as a result of this. And I suppose those things that I think are interrelated, I've made a starter for 10 as to how others can reflect on that, and they'll have their own views and their own contributions to make. But I suppose in simple terms, what I said is if you march for George Floyd, please march for the young woman that I mentioned earlier that died as a result of pollution in this city, or indeed for the Amerindian Brazilians who are being burnt out of the Amazon rainforest. Join the dots, because all of it is vital if black lives genuinely matter.
So I have this question because we are recording this podcast from the perspective of Londoners and people who live in cities who are urban. You know, when we think about Londoners and people from other big cities, do you think cities can lead the fight against the climate emergency? And in your mind, how are we doing that?
Well, actually, to be fair, one of the major initiatives where things are actually happening within the climate emergency and the climate movement is, in fact, in cities. So the truth is there is already a group of cities that come together under the banner of the C40, leading on climate change. And these are mayors like Sadiq Khan, the mayor of New York, the mayor of Chicago, Paris, that actually, in the absence of their countries sometimes doing nothing about climate, and I don't think the UK is doing enough, and it's definitely the case that Donald Trump's America wasn't doing enough, actually in cities, you can do a hell of a lot. You know, you can green buildings, you can mandate issues in relation to carbon emissions, in relation to public sector. You can come up with something like the congestion charge. There's a lot that you as a city mayor can do. You can't do everything, but you can do your bit. And often it's the case that actually the cities are moving ahead, but the nations are behind. And I suppose those mayors are recognising what they can see in real time, which is what underpins the inequality in their communities, and the way in which consumption, actually here in London, we're trying to create livable streets, pedestrianising, getting back to communities where people cycle, they're not jumping into cars, where roads are safe, environments for children to grow up in.
So if everything goes right, which is like I guess a pretty idealistic way of looking at the issue, but if everything does go right and we do everything we need to do in the next 10 years, what do you imagine London, Guyana, the world will look like in 2030?
Well, given that we're now entering into a deep recession, I want to see in 2030 us in richer countries have cut climate emissions substantially, disappearing. And I want to see new technologies, innovation, the New Deal at the centre of our economies. People employed in jobs that we can't even understand exist as we sit here today, 10 years before. You know, at the forefront, basically. That's what I want to see. And I want to see the countries that have been behind on this, the United States, that's about to change because Joe Biden's just been elected. Brazil, I hope we'll see the end of some of the destruction we're seeing in Brazil, have moved in a different direction, and poorer countries really assisted to do what they can. That will be a profound change, and climate denialism will have disappeared. The millennials will now be in charge, and they are a generation that get it. And so the whole language, lexicon, the way we talk about this, it will no longer be, we won't talk about climate change as a sort of afterthought or an add-on. It will be central to the debate, right at the centre of the discussion. I hope also that when we see NGOs protesting and championing that they are more diverse. It's a diverse crowd, and that our whole language is more integrated on these issues.
Yeah, that's a lot of change. That's a lot of change in 10 years, but it's achievable, right?
This is one of those things where it comes back to human nature. Do we have to wait until our house is on fire before we realise that we need to act?
Yeah.
Or do we realise now on behalf of our children? And I think that's why the millennials really get this. So I think quite a lot can happen in a short space of time, actually.
Yeah, we can fireproof the house in the next 10 years, definitely. Yes. That would be a good idea.
That is a wonderfully succinct way of putting it. Let's fireproof the house.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So let's say people listening are inspired by what you've said, feel like actually they want to be part of creating this hopeful future. What is one action? What is one thing that you would encourage people, listeners, to do who aren't already engaged in addressing the climate emergency?
If they're not engaged in the climate emergency, get engaged and realise that the climate emergency is not something that you can find to a silo called climate. If you are engaged and care about inequality, if you care about poverty, if you care about race and identity, if you care about gender, women, my God, think of women and where they find themselves, particularly in the global south, then get into this space, is what I would say.
And now it's time for our climate confessions. Let's fess up to the bad habits we just can't kick.
So, David, this is the part of the show, the part of the episode where we try our very best, because we're speaking to some very, very intelligent people. We're speaking to world leaders in climate change, in climate action. And I think for the listeners, it can sometimes feel like these people are superhuman. Do you know what I mean? It sometimes feels, especially me, I feel like they definitely get that vibe from me in particular. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring it back down to earth with some climate confessions. I'll give you an example to start off. So my one for this week, and we've been trying to come up with them every week. It's really hard, but also really easy, which is slightly distressing. My one this week is I actually Googled this before to check that it was relevant, but I have a really bad habit. I wouldn't call it OCD, but I'm very particular about things. So if I'm eating crisps, I have to put one in both sides of my mouth and chew at the same time. Or if I'm eating like jelly tots or fruit pastels, I have to have two, all of the five colors together. I'm just very particular about certain things. And one of those things is the way that I use toilet roll. So I have to pull off toilet roll and I fold it and I leave it before I use it. So I pull off like maybe five or six doubles and then I fold them. And if I pull off the wrong amount, then I have to start again. So I just waste a lot of toilet roll. I read a statistic that said that the average household uses 1 to 2 rolls of toilet roll a week, which I think is, you're nodding, which is making me feel quite insecure here, but I think that's ridiculous. I must get through like 5 or 6. I don't know, but I use way too much toilet roll, which obviously has an impact on the trees. It's also to do with, apparently they treat it with chemicals, which I didn't know. So it, allegedly it's really bad for the environment. So that's what I'm doing to screw it up this week.
That was graphic. So, that was more than I needed to know.
I didn't even actually, talk about poo.
Actually, you know, it was real because it's a problem. And it's the kind of consumer problem over here. Look, I guess, you know, I think I should eat less meat than I eat. Mm-hmm. I think that I'm tired of all the plastic bottles. I had one a moment ago that I'm always using. And maybe if I made a more active choice not to, I'm just throwing this plastic in the bin. I don't drive, so I'm not polluting the world in that way. But I think my consumption, I could do better than I'm doing, for sure.
Okay, that's good. That's good. That makes you feel slightly more human. Mariam, do you have one this week?
Thanks, Ben. Okay, so let me tell you my climate confession for the week. And as I said last week, I feel like every time we do these, people get to know us a little bit too much. So here's going again. As many of you who know me know, I have a slight clothing/shopping addiction. And I love clothes. And there's just no way to around it. I love it. I'm so into them. And they make me really happy. And I know that the fashion industry is just such a massive contributor to climate change. So I'm really trying hard to find sustainable options. But I'm going to tell you something. And this is, I guess, a plea to anyone listening who is in the fashion industry. As a plus size girl, I can't find that many options in sustainable fashion. So I would love to do better, but I kind of can't all the time. So that is my confession for the week and my plea for someone to find more than 5 items of sustainable clothing in my size in this country that ships to the UK.
I feel like both of you have kind of cheated this week, and next week I'm going to be a lot harsher on this. This is ridiculous. I'm the only person that's done anything wrong this week.
Okay, thank you so much, David, for joining us. It's an important conversation. It's one that I'm excited that we are having and that I hope we will continue to have on this podcast. And for those of you who are not part of the 800,000 people plus who have watched David's talk, I very much recommend that you go on TED.com and you watch this talk, because I think it's one of the best that's come out this year. And I know the best on this topic that is out there. So thank you, David, for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us this week. If you enjoyed what you listened to today, please rate and subscribe and share the episode with a curious friend. Join the conversation on socials using the hashtag ClimateCuriousPod and let us know what you want to hear about next time. You can find us online at TEDx London.
This podcast was made possible by TEDx London's headline partner, City. City is all about progress and supporting great ideas. And for the past 5 years, they've supported us to bring world-changing ideas to the TEDx London stage. Now they're taking it to the next level by supporting this new podcast. Thanks, City. This episode was produced by Josie Coulter. Curation and research by Tara Cooper. Engineered and mixed by Ben Beheshti. Artwork designed by Sabrina Russo and Rebecca Mingus. Music composed by Ben the Falcon Beheshti. Presented by Marian Pasha and Ben Hurst.
Stay curious.